You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Paula Morantz Cohen is my guest. Dr. Cohen is a professor at Drexel University in Philadelphia, and she's written several books of both fiction and nonfiction, including Of Human Kindness, What Shakespeare Teaches Us About Empathy, Suzanne Davis Gets a Life, Jane Austen and Scarsdale, or Love, Death, and SATs, and the book I just read, which is called Alfred Hitchcock, The Legacy of Victorianism. Paula Morantz Cohen, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much, Gary. I'm glad to be here.
If you don't mind me starting our conversation in sort of a random way, there was a sentence at the end of your book that really struck me, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was that audiences ceased to be concerned about what really happened and instead see images whose interpretations depend on individual political agendas, ethnic and class loyalties, and personal tastes. And that seems to me a recipe for disaster that has occurred. And I wonder how we got there.
Oh, that's such a big question, Gary. How we got there, I guess it's a mix of things. I think social media had something to do with it. It splintered us into factions and tribes in a way that when you think back at the time that Hitchcock was working, we had, you know, three major news outlets, and they gave us pretty much the same news. And I remember growing up thinking and being told that the two parties, political parties, were essentially the same, very, very little difference. And it couldn't be more different now. And, you know, I've been, since I'm at a technological university, we talk a lot about these algorithms that are used by websites to keep viewers on the sites. And what they do is they feed them more and more extreme stories. And those stories radicalize, or at least compartmentalize those viewers, so that they have ideas that are totally different from what other people maybe across the street are thinking. And I think that has fragmented our country greatly.
It's not a good thing, and obviously. But how do you feel that it connects with Alfred Hitchcock? I mean, did Hitchcock have anything to do with this? Not really.
I don't think so. I mean, I do think Hitchcock was an artist. He certainly wasn't representing reality in any documentary sort of way. But he was, I think, chronicling his age with great accuracy in his movies. And they also were movies that appealed to a very broad range of people. Actually, they still do. When my students still watch a Hitchcock film and find them not only scary, but fascinating and full of matter for discussion. And they cast light on our culture and on our, you know, on ourselves.
You know, today there's, you mentioned your students, and I teach film appreciation at Monterey Peninsula College. And I'm sensitive to my students and what they are feeling and what offends them. You know, they're very enlightened. And and that's a good thing. But they sometimes can only see the things that are offensive in film. And we've lived through, or we're in the middle of, this Me Too movement, in which a lot of actors and directors and producers are being blacklisted, so to speak, based on their behavior. What about Hitchcock's... I had Tippi Hedren on the show here, and she told me in no uncertain terms that she was sexually harassed in the worst possible way, that she refused his physical advances and he ruined her career. Does his personal behavior affect your interpretation of his films?
Well, that's a very good question. I know that, I think it was Donald Spoto that first revealed or first talked to Tippi Hedren about her experiences on The Birds in particular, and his behavior toward her. And I I had heard afterward, though, that there, you know, how extreme it was open to interpretation. But it's interesting that you spoke to her directly and she was in no uncertain terms telling you this. But, you know, I still feel that the art, the artifact stands on its own. And ironically, I do feel that Hitchcock's films reveal a great deal about gender inequity and gender issues at that point in time. And we can look at those films and we can see the abuses that existed. And I feel that at the same time that he was buying into that, he was also deconstructing it. And he was a very brilliant man. So I think he could do both at the same time. And so the Hitchcock blonde, who, you know, someone like, there's the film critic, Tanya Mudledsky, who accused Hitchcock, you know, used Hitchcock as emblematic of the male gaze. But it's also true that he used these women to heighten our sense of how the woman is positioned in culture, how vulnerable she is, and how, you know, I think when he has the Janet Leigh killed in the middle of Psycho, he's doing something very radical and making us think about the position of the woman as the spectacle in the film. So it's a complicated question. I'm not for canceling art and great art. There, we could go back and find so much. Picasso certainly was a very reprehensible character with women. But I do think Hitchcock was a great artist, and I would not sacrifice his films, though I feel deeply for Tippi Hedren's situation.
Well, you just mentioned the male gaze, and I want to ask you more about that. In your book, you said, narrative film shaped the world to the male gaze and clarified and empowered that gaze in the process. I wonder if you could tell me exactly what that's about. What is the male gaze and how does it, I know something about it in art, but tell us more about it.
Well, the idea that it objectifies the woman, it turns her into an object. And that it builds the plot, as it were, the narrative around her or despite her in some cases. And the woman is a kind of spectacle, a way of anchoring the gaze so that we know, you know, that there's something there that we can position ourselves with respect to. And I think that's certainly true in a lot of Hitchcock's films, but sometimes the woman as object of the gaze is so powerful that it kind of undermines or changes the dynamic or the balance. And I think that's what happens in culture. You have a certain kind of situation, but the victim or the object becomes amplified and takes on much more subjectivity than perhaps the artist may have imagined. But because it's I have dealt with this in Shakespeare. When Shakespeare creates a villain, his previous, the plots that he takes from other playwrights have a flat villain, but Shakespeare could not help but give his villain dimensions. And as a result, since the villains are other within the plot, we feel for them. And I'm thinking of Shylock in particular in The Merchant of Venice. Mm-hmm. They take on a human potential. And I think there's something similar goes on in Hitchcock. You know, I think of somebody like Lisa in Rear Window, who is so ornamental, but also has a kind of steeliness and a personality and a courage. I mean, when she goes across and of course, almost is threatened by the killer played by Raymond Burr. It forces us to think a little bit differently about these stereotypical gender roles.
Yeah, Grace Kelly is such an interesting figure in the Hitchcock films that she made. I guess maybe not so much in Dial M for Murder, because although I love Dial M for Murder, it's maybe not the most far-reaching artistic film that Hitchcock made. But in To Catch a Thief, the way that she is portrayed, or the way that she is in the movie, you know, she's so aggressive and hilarious, and also using that male gaze idea, I guess. And how
yeah,
much
I like that film a lot.
Yeah,
it's fun. And like North by Northwest, which is also a lot of fun. I mean, these are films that, you know, aren't as serious as something like Vertigo, which I think is a profound, profound film. And Rear Window, which is a very self-reflexive film because it's so much about the voyeur and watching and photographing and what the image means and how we interpret it. But those films are fun. But the women in them have a lot of strength and of character and a lot of pizzazz. And I enjoy watching them. I enjoy their wardrobes, but yeah. I also enjoy their character. Yeah, and of course, Hitchcock was very concerned about their wardrobes.
He was. Like, he picked every little thing, right?
Yeah.
He's like Scotty in Vertigo.
Yes, he had to dress his women just so. I think that in Edmund White's book, he makes a point, which I thought was really wonderful, that it might have something to do with Hitchcock's Jesuit training and the colors and the look of the saints. And that he may have been thinking about, because, you know, there are very definite colors attached to the various saints in Christian iconography, that maybe some of that filtered into Hitchcock's notion of how women should look. But he himself was very concerned about how he looked. Presumably, he had many, many suits in his closet, but they were all slightly different. So he was very aware of these small discriminations when it came to dress. And of course, his image was so, you know, he had such a definite image and appeared in his films, in every one of his films, in some signature way.
Right. I mean, Frank Capra doesn't appear in all of his films, or John Ford in all of his films. It's an Alfred Hitchcock thing. Only Hitchcock became the character that he was and appeared on television and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah, he branded himself. He was an incredibly brilliant at self-promotion, I think, and promotion of his brand.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, Fun KSCO, and we're talking this week with Paula Marantz Cohen. She's the author of Alfred Hitchcock, The Legacy of Victorianism. Paula Marantz Cohen is a professor of English at Drexel University, and she's the author of 6 nonfiction books on film, literature, and culture, and 6 novels.
I think there was an agreement among film producers when television first came in, and they saw television as such a huge threat, mm-hmm. that they would stay away from television, and they wouldn't go near television, and they wouldn't help television. And yet Hitchcock, pretty early on, became a fixture on television.
That's right. I think he had 2 shows, and, you know, he appeared in them at the beginning. And I think that's how he extended his brand again through television. He understood, I think he had a foresight that other filmmakers didn't have. When you look at television now, I think that Hitchcock probably anticipated the kinds of things that we're seeing in television now, where it has become, if anything, the real center for artistic expression.
Well, I think Frenzy is such a surprising film because in the 1970s, when the kind of new Hollywood occurred, and it kind of spelled the end for a lot of older directors, you know, nobody wanted to see, you know, what Henry Hathaway had to say anymore. But Hitchcock's film, it's a completely a Hitchcock film, but it completely embraces the new freedom of nudity, violence, language that he could use. And you talk extensively about it in your book. Students find it the most disturbing film now. I don't think people were as disturbed by it in 1972 as they are now.
That's interesting. I think you're right. I haven't shown Frenzy to my students, but I believe what you're saying, because, and again, I'm going to go to Shakespeare. My students are incredibly disturbed by King Lear and the scene in which Gloucester has his eyes taken out. And, you know, thinking about all the violence that they see on television, it's interesting that, and of course, in Frenzy, the direct showing of the strangling and the strangled woman is it's graphic, it's real. It has a reality to it, I think, that the violence that they're seeing doesn't have. And the same is true, even when they read Shakespeare and the putting out of Gloucester's eyes, they feel a visceral sense of its reality. And, you know, that's what, even though Hitchcock was stylized in so many ways, there is a reality to what he represents. And particularly in that film, and you do feel that he's trying to adjust himself to the demands of the moment. He could only go so far. I mean, this was a period where we were having a lot of counterculture type films, as well as the big blockbuster James Bond films. And in both instances, he really wasn't suited to that. But I do think Frenzy is a very disturbing film and a great film. And of course, it was also a film where he went back to his native London and shot it there. So I think there's a certain familiarity and a sense of nostalgia that permeates the contemporary in that film as well.
And the villain is a greengrocer, and I think that's part of Hitchcock's own past, right?
That was his father's job, yes.
Yeah. And that was also in, is it Sabotage, the one that has the greengrocer being the cop who's a...
Yeah. Yes. Is it Sabotage? Yes. That's based on The Secret Agent.
Right.
With the Conrad novel, which he had already used that title for another film. But that film, Sabotage, was not a success. And he often said that it was because he based it on a great novel and he would never do that again.
It's interesting. Novels are great and movies are great, but very few great movies are based on great novels. I mean, if a novel is great, it doesn't really lend itself. Maybe Gone with the Wind is the exception, but mostly you like the book better than the movie. I just saw the new James Bond movie last night.
Oh, did you? Did you like it?
And it was the first time that I've been to the movies since February of 2020. So it was a long time between movies for me. I liked it very much. And I was thinking about Hitchcock because I had just read your book, Paula Marenko, and Hitchcock, The Legacy of Victorianism. And I was struck by the fact that although the male gaze, as you were describing it, is still a major feature of James Bond, it's downplayed slightly in the new film. Although there's lots and lots and lots and lots of killing. I mean, there's just hundreds of people killed. And when you think of a Hitchcock film, there are very few actual murders in his films. And in Frenzy, for instance, which we were just talking about, yes, there's this graphic murder. But then the other murders just happen off screen or behind closed doors. That's sort of a chilling way that he pulls away from the window where you know that your character that you like is about to be.
That's chilling. Absolutely. When he goes down the staircase with the camera and you know that, you know, she's gone into her death. That is, I think, yeah, more frightening than seeing the actual murder. And even in Psycho, you know, the fact that the knife never really touches her flesh. Of course, we think it does, but that is an interesting, artful way in which he was able to film that famous shower scene.
Yes. And then in that same film, when Martin Balsam is killed, it's very almost balletic the way he goes down the stairs. I don't know how they shot that, but that's an amazing little moment in the film.
Yeah. No, there's an artfulness. And you're right that murder, I mean, now... there's so much of it that it loses its dramatic punch.
You know, we talk about how enlightened everyone is now, but I think that in 20 years or less, they may look back at a lot of the violence that we watch on television and in the movies as extremely excessive and detrimental to society.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting that certain things take on a charge and are repudiated and other things are ignored. And I think that is the nature of culture. You know, I just was in a class today that was discussing the musical, one of my absolute favorite musicals, Guys and Dolls. Mm-hmm. And some of the women in the class were very offended by the relationship between Adelaide and Nathan Detroit. I just think it's just so interesting how they will zero in on something and, you know, not see the context. And that's really the issue in so much of this, to see the context. And I feel with Hitchcock, great artists are able to create a context so that even though their work is of their time, you feel you can see around it, or that they can see around it, and it becomes of all time. And that is really true, I think, of Hitchcock's films. They will endure.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Paula Marantz Cohen. She's the author of Alfred Hitchcock, The Legacy of Victorianism. Paula Marantz Cohen is a professor of English at Drexel University, and she's the author of 6 nonfiction books on film, literature, and culture, and 6 novels.
Your book is called The Legacy of Victorianism. So let me ask you, what is Victorianism, and where do we see it in Hitchcock?
Well, I think he was a Victorian. He was born during the end of the Victorian era. He came from a very sort of prudish, you know, religious family. He was a family man and very kind of straight-laced, for all that we find out about some of his behavior that was aberrant. But I think that what he did, and I think he had an understanding of the whole Victorian ethos, which was in his society, but also in the literature that he read as a young man. And even though the only book of that period, or a little bit later, that he adapted was the Joseph Conrad novel, nonetheless, I think that his films reflect a transmutation of the Victorian ethos into the modern era. So he took what had been a literary tradition and he made it dynamic, cinematic. But I still feel there's a moral element, which was very much in the Victorian mindset. There's a moral element that drives his films. And that's another reason. I mean, that's what attracted me to the Victorians. That's my original field of study. This moral sense that you find in Dickens and George Eliot and Henry James. And I feel that the same sense is there in Hitchcock, but it's transmuted into a visual dynamic medium. And particularly in American medium, even though he was British, the fact that we had film was an American form in that it was able to create stories initially without words. I mean, there were intertitles, but it was really more about images. And so as a result, could free itself from some of the European influence that had so dragged America down. And so I think that Hitchcock's an interesting bridge character. He was British, he was Victorian, but he went into film and he became central to the studio system for a long period of time. And he really stretched from the very beginning of narrative film to the end of the studio system. So, you know, from the silent era to 1975, when his last film was made. I don't know if that exactly, I have quite a lot of elements in my book that deal with the Victorian state of mind, but I think it might get a little complicated if I go into it in too much detail.
Well,
I think the moral piece is the most important piece.
I was just going to say, let's take the moral piece and tell me, can you give me some examples in Hitchcock of this moral stand?
Well, I think that every one of his films has a complex moral thrust to it. Take Shadow of a Doubt, which is one of my favorites. I think it was one of Hitchcock's favorites. And it is an exploration of small town life. And it is looking at the way in which evil really can penetrate into the everyday unless we are vigilant. In fact, that's the last, one of the last lines in the movie is we have to be constantly vigilant. And you have this wonderful young woman played by Teresa Wright, who is, I mean, she has to go through this terrible disillusionment in finding out that her beloved uncle, after whom she was named, is a murderer. And that's a fall. That's a fall into, you know, from innocence into experience. But it's also, it's a moment of enlightenment, that this is what the world is like, and one must take great care in dealing with other people and thinking about where they're coming from. I feel it's a very profound movie.
In other words, Uncle Charlie is right when he says, you don't know what the world is like out there, you know, behind the facade of all these homes.
Absolutely.
It's
what is that?
It's a complete destruction of Teresa Wright's world.
And yet it's not, because at the end, she's going to marry the detective, and she's going to stay right there and raise a family. So I don't feel it's nihilistic. I feel it's realistic about the fact that you, again, you have to be vigilant. And, you know, she was just so open and so innocent in the way she responded to her uncle. And she, that's a loss, but it's a gain as well. So, I mean, that's how I see the movie. I know there are a lot of ways you can see the movie.
Well, it's one of the great performances, I think, of an actress in film. I think it's definitely an underrated, she's a wonderful actress, but she's just so great in that film and completely believable.
It's wonderful. And the opening of that film, I don't know if you remember, as a Philadelphian, mm-hmm. I love the opening because the first scene is Philadelphia and it's kind of gritty and you see children playing in the street, and then it goes in through the window. One of Hitchcock's favorite maneuvers goes in through the window, and you see Joseph Cotten, Uncle Charlie, lying on the bed in his boarding house. And he has that almost like a vampire, that lethargic, you know, almost dead look to him. And there's money scattered around. And then you shift to Santa Rosa, California, and you see young Charlie with her hands behind her head lying on her bed. And she's kind of bored and upset that her mother's been taken advantage of. And it's a point counterpoint that sets things up so beautifully. I mean, visually, nobody can do things more succinctly than Hitchcock, as he does there. And in the beginning of Rear Window as well.
There's a certain satisfaction in that symmetry. And I think that's one of the, maybe the subtexts or underlying things that when you're watching Shadow of Doubt for the first time, you might not even think of it. And then when you see it repeatedly, there are more and more of these symmetrical things. They go to she's got two buttons on her blouse. They go to a place called 2 o'clock and they order a double. And there's all these double, you know,
doubling. Yeah. I didn't know that. I hadn't noticed those things. Thank you. But a lot of doubling. Yeah. So yes. And you realize how artful the film is, how well structured it is. You know, Hitchcock said that he saw everything before he even began to shoot. It was all in his mind's eye, and he was bored by the time I don't know if that's true.
I don't believe him. Yeah.
No, I don't either. I think he liked manipulating the actors and all of that stuff. But he also knew how to make a pithy comment.
And he was so funny. And his films are as you were mentioning before, they're so hilarious. We're just talking about the that scene in To Catch a Thief when they're kissing on the sofa. And then there's this huge fireworks. And
yes.
then when he pulls Eva Marie Saint into bed with him on the train, and then they go into a tunnel.
Yes.
Some very unsubtle but hilarious.
Not subtle, but nonetheless. Not what they would do nowadays. And
right.
I think it's terrific. I mean, why be subtle? But yes, those are wonderful moments. And a lot of funny moments in, I mean, even something like in Strangers on a Train, where he has the tennis match and everybody's head is going back and forth, except that Bruno is staring straight ahead. It's creepy and scary, but it's also funny.
Yeah.
And so he's able to combine those things so well.
Now, you talk a bit in your book, Paula Morantz Cohen, Alfred Hitchcock, The Legacy of Victorianism, about Hitchcock's daughter and how he cast her in his films occasionally and what that meant. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think his daughter was an important figure in his life. I mean, so was his wife, who was worked with him at least for a while. She did continuity with him on his films and then sort of dropped away. But his daughter, who went into acting and trained in Britain, the Royal Academy, was in, is it three films, I think, Stage Fright, Psycho, and Strangers on a Train. And he always puts her in these sort of secondary roles where she's not flattering roles. Well, I have this elaborate theory, and I don't want to bore people with it. I had written a previous book about the 19th century novel and the daughter's role in the novel. And my point is this, and I think it fits, it's carried through in Hitchcock's films and connects to his relationship with his daughter, that with the development of the nuclear family, which really solidified in the 19th century, the 18th century into the 19th century. Before that, it was a more extended family. The patriarchal nuclear family was based on the idea of romantic love. And the idea was that the man would find a complement in his wife. But as we know, you can fall in love and the other person seems to be the perfect complement, but let it continue on for a while. It doesn't seem like such a perfect complementarity. However, when you have a daughter, if a father has a daughter, it's possible to shape the daughter to be a complement to the father. And I see 19th century novels as very much connected to this notion of father-daughter complementarity. And I think that the same is true with Hitchcock, in that I think his daughter served a certain role in the family, but the problem occurs, and this is true in novels, which end at the courtship point. 19th century novels end when the daughter is moving out of the family, so you don't see what happens next. But with Hitchcock, I think when his daughter reached a certain age, it became very problematic for him. And you see some of that disturbance being acted out in the way he casts her, and also perhaps in some of the behavior that he had with someone like Tippi Hedren. I don't know if that is persuasive. It's a little bit elaborate. You'd have to read my earlier book, The Daughter's Dilemma, Family Process in the 19th Century Domestic Novel. But I do think that given how close-knit the Hitchcock family was, and there was only one child, a daughter, and the fact that he cast her in three of his movies, and she plays always a certain kind of unpleasant role. He also made fun of her in various ways and played tricks on her, presumably on set. I find this all very interesting and is connected, I think, to that issue of the daughter leaving the family behind and moving into another space, her own family, and that the films become a way of representing that.
Well, Patricia Hitchcock just passed away during this last
year. Yes.
And you got a chance to meet her, speak with her? Did you run any of this?
I did. And I have to say that she would probably be appalled if she heard what I said. She was very, very, and she, I think, was very, she was. Would hear nothing negative about her father. And I don't know, and have not read, perhaps you have, how she responded to Tippi Hedren's accusations. I would imagine she said they're not true.
Yeah.
Because she was very protective of him.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot in this in this book, Dr. Cohen. I really enjoyed it, and every page gave me stuff to think about and wanting to go back and look at the films again, of course. It's Paula Morantz Cohen, the brilliant author of Alfred Hitchcock, The Legacy of Victorianism. And thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Gary. It was really a pleasure talking with you, somebody who knows and loves Hitchcock so much.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.